Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugas and Heather Fowler. Today, we are excited to feature Gina Frangello, author of Blow Your House Down, published by Counterpoint Press in 2021.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? Well, we thought that having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a fun idea. Today, we're drinking an Aperol Affair inspired by Gina's book. The recipe is on Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
For those not familiar with Gina's work, among many other accomplishments, Gina Frangello is the author of 4 books of fiction, most recently A Life in Men, now under development as a series on Netflix, and Every Kind of Wanting, included by both Chicago Magazine and the Chicago Review of Books as one of the best books of 2016. Her fiction and nonfiction have appeared in venues such as Plowshares, Fence, Salon, Psychology Today, the Boston Globe, and more. She has served as the fiction editor at The Nervous Breakdown, the faculty editor for TriQuarterly Online, and the Sunday editor of The Rumpus. Her debut memoir, Blow Your House Down, is the book we will feature today.
For a long time, Gina Frangello tried to escape an early life of poverty and violence. Later, a wife and mother, her life becomes affected by the death of a close friend and a passionate affair. These, along with her aging, sick parents, enable her to see more clearly the problems in her marriage as she commences to live a double life and tries to hold the secret of her relationship and her feelings close. However, when she reveals these secrets, the carefully controlled world she has tried to create will come crashing down. Blow Your House Down is a story about how society forces women into narratives of giving everything of themselves until there is nothing left. In this book, Frangello reveals, through her own experiences, the struggle women face as they push against what is expected of them, as they experience violence, feel and suppress rage, and become sick as a result. Women can find and reclaim their sense of self and their life, as Frangello shows through the powerful story she shares. We are pleased to have her with us today.
Yay! How are you feeling, Gina?
I'm good. I'm in California, so it's all good.
You and me both. So you're on Pacific Standard Time too?
I am. We're here temporarily, but it's nice to be away from the snow. It was crazy in Chicago when I left.
Oh, yeah. So how long will you be here?
Until mid-April.
Okay, wonderful. Well, today we're so looking forward to talking with you about your work and also having you give us a reading later on. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
I don't not enjoy them. I do. I always think I'm going to go too fast because I was scolded all through elementary school for reading too quickly.
Oh, wow. You know, it's so funny. When I was in graduate school, I had a professor who said one thing to me after I gave a reading there. He said 2 words for you, louder, slower. So I'm hearing you.
I don't think anyone's ever told me to be louder, but the slower part, yes.
Oh, well, you know, the introverts among us.
Yes, all of us here. Gina, can you talk a little bit about how this book fits in with your author trajectory?
Well, yeah, definitely. I've been working on short form nonfiction for many years. I mean, I've probably published my first personal essay in maybe around 2001. So it's definitely been part of my life as a writer, just not in book form. So I was originally thinking that I was going to do a series of essays about caregiving my parents, who lived in the house with me for many years. And a number of those essays had been placed in various different places. And so I was compiling them and I realized there was a lot of repetition between them. And then I also sort of realized that I was a peripheral narrator in all these pieces, that I wasn't putting very much of myself into them, which has to do with having not wanted to cop to unhappiness earlier on, or the, you know, the complexity of what was going on in my life. Or then later, of course, when I was leading a double life, not wanting to talk about that. And so I went back and sort of really ripped those pieces open and tried to tell a fuller version. And then that led me to start writing other things, some of which I was writing privately and didn't think would make it into the book. But the more I went forward and then my showed work to my writers group, they were like, okay, this has got to go in the book because it's all part of the same whole. And so mainly, I think I was working on this book because I couldn't write fiction at that time. I just had a block. And I really realized I had to, in a way, tell this story in order to get over the wall.
Yeah. When you're talking about that, I'm thinking about the role of a caregiver. It's really like this invisible space you inhabit because all your focus is on the other person. So I think that probably plays into it a little bit too.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
That's intense. Yeah. And I'm really interested too, when I was reading this book, in the role of the idea of the disclaimer, probably because I'm terrified of creative nonfiction, right? I only write fiction. So I think a lot about, oh, nobody can know that. I'm not going to tell, you know, like something right, like right. that. And so I notice when I'm reading this book, there's a lot of different ways in which you're kind of intricately dancing through a disclaimer, like both with the many paths, other worlds kind of meditations, mm-hmm. and the, like the Scarlet A worn too proudly for your taste passage in particular. So my question for you is, craft-wise, was this a feminist effort on your part to three-dimensionalize the role of a quote-unquote adulteress by adding the kind of complexity of her self-awareness as a villain figure? Or maybe go into the possible paths that would give her different levels of morally correct / above reproach? Or were they maybe a nod to the internalized shame narratives that are socialized for women?
Well, I think all of those things are factors in life, right? But I would never want to write a narrative in which I was positing myself as above reproach. I probably wouldn't want to read a narrative in which the author was positing themselves that way. I think that in nonfiction, we have to be willing to look at least as harshly at ourselves as we are at anyone else in the text. But what does interest me, so you mentioned the disclaimer in the beginning. So in certain cases, I used composite characters, such as the character of Angie in Substitute Beauty in that section. She's a composite character. So obviously, that's not one real whole person. And so you need a disclaimer and so forth. But I also am really interested in the way that the minute we put something down onto paper and turn it into language, it stops being the person that it represents to a certain extent. Like you're only able to represent some kind of facsimile of everyone, including yourself. And I think a lot about that. I've written a lot about that before in terms of writing the body. So for example, like you have a terrible headache, and no matter what words you use to say about your headache, you can't make someone else have your headache. And so I feel that language is both miraculous and slippery, and I don't like it. I mean, I've been, of course, in the literary community for many years, and I've seen many memoirists deal with the fact that people will read a book and then think they know not only everything about the person who wrote the book, you know, as though they know their entire life, but also everyone else who's in the book. And I see a memoir as really being sort of the visible part of an iceberg, and there's 80% submerged, because if we even wrote a book that told everything about one day in our life, we'd have several telephone book volumes. Yeah. So I really tried to stay focused on the fact that, yes, this is a curated thing through my point of view, exploring different lenses, different forms, trying to kind of wrestle with things, which is what I think we do as writers, and not trying to say this was the totality, this is everything. So basically that doesn't negate the idea of internalized shame narratives or anything like that, because there certainly are those, and I've struggled with that too. But I guess I saw that that's a separate thing, and also in the book.
yeah, definitely.
I like the idea of the facsimile that you're talking about. I wanted to ask you, kind of looping back to when you were talking about your process and how your book fits with your author trajectory. And you talked about writing some of the pieces before. I wonder if you could expand a little bit more on the process for writing the book and how you put everything together.
Oh, absolutely. So I started out by basically compiling all the personal essays that I had ever published in my life. I didn't include a few that were maybe like popular culture based, where I was talking about a movie or something like that, even if there was personal material in it. But I took everything that was sort of out of time, that was strictly personal, and put it all together in one document. And I was like, oh, okay, here's my essay collection. And then I really realized, like I said, first of all, the level of repetitions, because I had published a bunch of pieces about caregiving my parents. And my parents were very eccentric, interesting people. But every time you write an essay, you have to ground the reader in the story from scratch. Right? It's completely self-contained. So the first thing I realized was just the immense numbers of repeated material, etc. I started taking all of that out. And in some cases, that stripped the essay down where it no longer really worked. You could take a bit and add it to another one. But also, I had originally started the piece in 2001 with adopting my daughters and went forward from there. And I actually ended up really realizing that in order to kind of unlock myself as a character to the reader, I needed to go back further. I needed to show myself before being an adult, kids, and all of that. And I needed to sort of go back and actually interrogate aspects of my life. So I started taking things out and putting things in. And then some of the things that went in ended up being in sort of strange form. Like I have a dictionary of mutually understood words about sort of the language of an affair. And that's an homage, obviously, to Milan Kundera's short dictionary of misunderstood words between Sabina and Franz. And I love Kundera, even though, God, he's such a sexist, it's absolutely comedic. But I do love his work. He's a great practitioner of the editorial omniscient point of view, which I'm kind of obsessed with. So I started sort of building new pieces and mainly trying to fill in a lot of gaps because of having been almost absent from the essays that I'd previously written. So I was trying to fill in a lot of gaps about myself. And then actually the piece that I'm going to read today, which is the opening of the book, turned out to be the last thing I wrote because I had been taking all these notes very furiously throughout. And in the end, I guess you could say the notes became the book, which is something that my husband has said to me about his memoir, like the notes are the book. And it turned out to be true in this case, in the opening. But also the very last section called The Cartographer's 50 Meditations, that I had originally seen as a separate piece. I didn't see that as part of this book. I was going to stop the book prior to my cancer diagnosis, right after the death of my dad. And I ultimately came to realized that despite there having been craft reasons, which I could get into if you're interested, but there were reasons that I thought I wanted to end where I originally wanted to end. But then this other material, according to basically everyone who was looking at it, was part of the whole of all the things I was trying to explore. So I ended up adding it.
Well, it probably felt like a very cohesive whole when you reached what you thought was an ending. And then the dream of this book in your mind probably just kind of stopped at that point. So you needed outside people to say, no, this is really actually it too, probably. Well, I'm curious because you have so many different literary allusions in the book and other authors that you reference. What works did you feel like were stylistically informing this piece as well as Kundera? Do you have any other thoughts you'd like to?
Definitely. I mean, I feel like I've been very influenced by a lot of nonfiction writers. I love Sarah Manguso. I love Maggie Nelson. I absolutely completely revere the work of Emily Ratt Black, who's my business partner and good friend. But also a lot of fictional books influence my style as well. I mean, I think The Book of Daniel by E.L. Doctorow has maybe been the most formative book of my life in the sense that I loved the way the storyteller, who is not Doctorow, it's the first person narrative of Daniel, who's kind of the son of a fictional Rosenberg couple, the executed Rosenbergs. And so he is writing the book as his thesis in a PhD program, and it sort of goes off the rails. So sometimes he's talking to the reader, sometimes he's referring to himself in the third person, sometimes he's telling a story he wasn't there to see. I've also been really influenced by Maxine Hong Kingston's The Woman Warrior for some of those same reasons in terms of speculative nonfiction, where the author can imagine things that happen when she's not there. And I don't have scenes here where I'm not in them, so that's not what I mean. But just the way that those books taught me that the lens, like whose eyes you're looking through, is really what determines whether a book is fiction or nonfiction. Primarily, it's sort of like that guide, Maxine Hong Kingston, Woman Warrior. She can be writing about a shaman in China before she was ever born, or ghosts or something like that. And it remains so rooted in her voice and her perspective and what she needs from those stories and what she's seeking that, you know, you don't lose track. You're not like, now I'm reading a fantasy story. You're always with her.
Yeah, definitely.
In the book, you talk about falling short as a daughter, a mother, a wife, and feeling reduced in many ways. Mm-hmm. A lot of women, especially those who are middle-aged, find themselves as caregivers for aging parents and for their own children, often at the same time. And that stretches them emotionally and physically so thin, almost invisible, really. Can you speak to the notion of the desexualization of middle-aged women that's found in your book?
Absolutely. I mean, so there's two things. So you were talking about kind of how caregiving multiple people, so you know, say in my case, three kids, two elderly parents who had profound health troubles and at times were disabled and were often hospitalized, sometimes at the same time in different places, sometimes etc. So all of that and the busyness and kind of the chaos of having to run around and be everything to everyone, I think is very emptying of a person. Like you stop knowing where your internal life or your own self fits in. It's just sort of the constant dashing and caretaking. So that's certainly true. And I think is experienced by many, many women in every culture, right? Because that's just, there's not a lot of places in the world where women are not the primary caregivers. So there's definitely that just in terms of how a woman is supposed to navigate having an actual independent life while all these things are going on. And in my case, I think I did a really good job of making it look like I had one. I mean, I always did work. And I mean, I worked a lot of nonprofit unpaying jobs throughout my life. I've had a lot of indie press and nonprofit editorships and so forth. But I also taught at the university level. I did a lot of different things. I've always had a lot of friends and so forth. So I don't think that anyone looking at my life from the outside, like I didn't look like someone who it was like, oh, she never leaves the house. All she does is take care of family. But I had kind of emptied myself out where I was not really able to talk about myself to people. I was almost pathologically private because it didn't feel like anything I would have to say would be acceptable or was part of the narrative that I was supposed to be carrying on. And so people were always telling me like, oh, you're so wonderful to your parents. You're so amazing. And then this is a whole other thing, which is offensive, but like when you adopt, people praise you unnecessarily, which is actually fully wrong because your children are not a philanthropic effort. They're your children, but you still get that. And so I was always hearing from the outside kind of how great I was for these various things. And I was just feeling emptier and emptier and emptier. And not because I didn't love my children and my parents, because they've been the most important people in the world to me. My parents and I were actually insanely close. I'm an only child and my children are magnificent, but just trying to have all these things at the same time and also trying to have a marriage at the same time. And so there's all of that in terms of just at a certain point feeling like you don't have a self. But also, yes, the desexualization of middle-aged women, the desexualization of mothers, such that we would even have a term like MILF, because that implies that normally you would fully not want to fuck anyone who is a mother, right? I mean, if you have to specify that someone is a MILF, it basically indicates that most mothers are outside the realm of sex. And so particularly as you get older, and then as I went further into the narrative, and it was one of the reasons that I chose to include the section where I get breast cancer and I end up having chemo and having a bilateral mastectomy, and then later due to complications having a hip replacement, was because it just gets ratcheted up. You know, so first you're a mom, maybe you're in your early 30s, but suddenly you're weirdly being desexualized, de-individualized. Now you're in your 40s. Okay, you're really supposed to not be a sexual being or have desires, etc. Okay, now you don't have breasts, you're limping because you have a temporary disability, you're bald, etc. Like it's just sort of as you progress as a woman, as you get older, as maybe your body starts to fail in certain ways and you have illnesses or struggles, the culture just further and further marginalizes you out of the discourse of sexuality and out of the realm of desire. And because that was so not my personal experience, I felt like, well, listen, nobody is singular in this world. If that's not my personal experience, there are a lot of other women out there who are pushing 50, who have had illnesses or disabilities, who have several children and who still feel like, no, I'm still myself. I'm still a person who is full of desires. And we're being told in a sense, not even that we shouldn't have them, but for example, in like the cancer literature, there's often this kind of rhetoric where it's like, well, if you don't feel like you're sexual anymore, it's okay. We understand. You've been through trauma. Try cuddling. Try massage.
Just cut it off. It's fine.
You know, and it's like, yay, cuddling, yay, massage. But why are you telling me that I am not going to want other forms of sexuality anymore? And so it just became complex. I did a piece for Covey Club that ended up on Healthline on sexuality after breast cancer. I interviewed tons of women. So this became kind of a real puzzle that I was working on that ended up making its way into the book.
Yeah, I think that's so resonant. And I've been thinking a lot about how the Me Too movement sweeping Hollywood has created a dynamic where a lot of women actresses who had a certain level of power, like Reese Witherspoon and others, are kind of reclaiming the ability to write proactive narratives for women who are a little older, which is awesome, right? There's more roles now, I feel, that are giving complexity to women at an age that was like the unfuckable age or something like that, like you're referring to, essentially aging out of being attractive. But then you also have the cosmetic industry as a multi-billion dollar industry telling us we need to dye our hair, we need to put things on our skin, we need to purchase plastic surgery to look younger. Like,
well, the hashtag that was floating around Twitter this week, I can't remember it exactly, but it was like,
was it that don't look your age thing?
Yeah.
I haven't seen any don't look your age ones because everyone in my feed is sort of like, fuck you, here's a picture of me looking my age.
Exactly. So that's what I saw too.
So, but I gathered from inference that that was going around in right. other circles of social media, of which I'm not a part. I actually really do kind of want to applaud, not that they care, but a lot of shows on cable for giving roles more prominently to women who are over 40. I definitely think that. I mean, we've got Sarah Jessica Parker in The Divorce. We've got the characters in Friends from College. We've got Aunt Poll in Peaky Blinders. I mean, there are quite a number of them. I think that television is becoming a much better place for actresses after a certain age. I do feel like it's starting to change in the book industry, but I think the book industry is behind Hollywood, which is a really weird thing to say because normally that would not be true. But I think that the book industry is really full of memoirs about kind of like the misspent youths of people, particularly women, with sort of all the mistakes one made in one's teens or 20s, or all the traumas one suffered in one's teens or 20s. And then at the end, it's sort of like, okay, and then I got married and had children. And there's almost this inference of like, and happily ever after, but the book ends and the person goes on when it's memoir. And just from what I know in life and books that I've read, it doesn't end there. These people continue to have stories. And so I think that the reason I originally wanted to end with the Blood Moon section of The Death of My Father was because my ex-husband and I were done, but it had left my then lover and me in a very precarious position where you really weren't sure whether we would end up together or not. And I liked the idea of ending the book that way. I liked the idea of not ending with myself, the character of myself on the page, repartnered exactly. And so that was a big resistance to not wanting to take the narrative further. But there were other forces that made me want to take it further. And so I had to then end up including the fact that we did end up living together and we're now married. We didn't get married during the time of the book, though.
But that, I'm sure, just accelerated the sense of pressure, right? Like if you end the book and you guys are together, it's almost like a narrative is forever carrying forward into the future. So if anything more happens, I don't know. It feels like it would almost be something you have to reflect on in a future narrative if anything changes. Does that make any sense?
Like, it does. It does, because I mean, obviously, if you're in the literary world, you certainly do know people who wrote memoirs or modern love pieces or something about people who then they're no longer with, as though, and here's how I found my forever happiness and so forth. I try really hard in the book to distinguish between love and certainty. I think that the only constant in life is change, and that no one can really make guarantees of anything. We know what we want in the moment and probably for the fairly near future, but we are always changing. And someone who got partnered up initially 4 days after my 22nd birthday and then had a long marriage, you end up on the other side of that. You're a completely different person than you were when you met someone. And so even though I do end up repartnered and so forth, I try to address in the narrative the fact that there are many complications of the idea of this being the end. We sail into the sunset. Everything is fabulous. And just that, first of all, I think people who come together in midlife also come together with a lot of baggage and demons and so forth. And I mean, I tried to really portray the things that my then lover, now husband, and I had to kind of work through, and that it wasn't just sort of like, oh, true love, we had this affair, we ended our marriages, and oh, everything was perfect from that moment on, because that's not how it works. And I think that if I had skipped over, I mean, that was probably some of the hardest stuff to write about, was how difficult things were between us for a while. You don't want to write about things like that when now they're great. But I felt like it was really important to show, because I think there is an issue of, people call it the affair bubble, and I think that's too simplistic, but there certainly is a lot of complexity to the fact that a relationship is far different when you're not each other's primary person on the ground, and that you have to really go through a lot to figure out if you can be that for each other and what that will look like. So,
Yeah, when there's no triangulation and when there's not all these other elements of what you're escaping or feeling oppressed by in combination with this other kind of magical idea, I think. But yeah, I think you did a great job with that in this book. Something else that really interested me in the narrative, well, first I would add also that I think that there was definitely a lot more realism when you bring in the issue of a mental illness, when you bring in the issue of a heavy depression, because anyone who has had any sort of mental illness at all is going to completely know that that's a game changer in a relationship, right? So I thought you did a really delicate, lovely job of
that.
Thank you. Yeah, just to add that briefly. But I also felt like there was this wonderful theme that I was following. You know, what triggers me as I'm reading, I see a theme that I'm interested in, and then I kind of follow it through the book as it's moving. And I felt like there was this theme of responses to male anger and male violence moving through this book. And I was really fascinated, not just by the impact of this on our protagonist, but also on her relationships with other women. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, it feels like some of the narrator's biggest fears, realized or not, biggest moral crises were the devastation of friendships, the loss of other women in their life, the impact of the affair on the other woman, all of these other things. Can you maybe speak to, in your mind, for you, is this a book that's at least half about women? Because it did feel like there was a strong angle there.
Oh, God, yes. I hope so. I didn't in any way intend to write a novel a memoir that was just about men. I just said novel because I've written fiction primarily, but I've never set out to write a novel that was strictly about only one gender. So usually in everything I write, I try to highlight relationships both between women as well as between women and men. And in this book, certainly, I mean, the formative relationship that I had with the character of Angie, who is based on a few different really formative relationships in my childhood, and my friendship with Alicia, which is a constant throughout the book. I don't talk a lot about it, but she's in the book at every stage. And then, of course, my world crashing down after my friend Kathy died, and how much of a catalyst for sort of crisis and change that was, based on our kind of really loving, but in a sense, a very interdependent relationship that I think I didn't realize I depended on as much as I actually did, because she was more overtly dependent on me. But as is often true, the person who's being depended on is just as hooked into that dynamic. So definitely, and I tried for that reason to also, I mean, one of the most important things for me in the book, and the idea of writing a memoir at all, was that it's important to be the lens, it's important to have a strong point of view, but I also wanted to include a lot of outside source material and to talk about the way in which my life is just a jumping point to thinking about roles of women in general in many different systems, the medical system, the legal system, psychology, all these different things, and literature, of course. And so for me, yes, a memoir tells your story, and it better tell it engagingly or people don't want to read it. But in a sense, I don't think of it as a book about me. I think of it as a book about my realizing a lot of various things in terms of where my life fits in to a much bigger cultural narrative. And so it's more to me about that cultural narrative and my discovery of it and my kind of wrestling with it.
Yeah. I definitely picked up on that and connected with that too. Some of the most powerful parts in the book for me were about leading a double life and how lying can make a person sick, which I absolutely believe. In your book, you talk about living this experience and then how you talked about it and shared your truth with the people in your life. I was wondering about how writing about it and publishing that writing impacted you, how taking it to the next level, so to speak, the very public revelation in your book felt to you with respect to that.
Yeah, I mean, living a double life is a bad idea. It's just, it's not good for anybody. And it's still a thing that I wrestle with, like, why and how did I do that. The level of erasure. So already, as I was saying earlier, you're already coming from this place where it's like you're taking care of three kids, you're taking care of two elderly sick parents, you're trying to maintain a marriage, you're trying to maintain several different careers at once, trying to maintain friendships. And you almost feel like, wait, where am I? Where am I? You're always shifting to meet some other need. But then you turn around and like you start having an affair and leading a double life. And really, I mean, there's a saying in kind of the recovery community of like that when you're using and no one knows it, like even saying hello to someone is a lie. And I mean, I think that's true of any form of a double life. It's not exclusive to addiction. So for a period of time, it's like you can be with these people who you love enormously, who are so important to you, and they don't know you anymore. You're not saying anything to them that is really front and center in your life. Like the things you're saying to them may be true. Oh, I read this book. It was interesting. Oh, I want to go here. Oh, this happened at work. Or my kid did this cute thing. But you're behind a veil and people can't know you. And it is sick making. And I want to make clear that I am not saying like, oh, I got breast cancer because I was leading a double life. Like I do not want that to be the message that anyone takes away from the book, because I think that's actually quite sickening, the way that people try to find a way to blame people for their illnesses. And I think that's very convenient for people who are not sick to think that, oh, well, that person must have done something wrong. They smoked, they drank, they lied. Perfect people get sick. There aren't perfect people. My mother was a person who never did anything for anyone but herself and was quite literally the nicest person I've ever met in my entire life. And she had 17 surgeries and was sick for 13 years straight before she died. So I'm not making any equations there, but definitely I felt a lot of toxicity of leading a double life and lying by omission. And for me, writing about it, I mean, yes, it's scary, obviously, you know, you're really just waiting for all the people to say like what horrible person you are. But that being said, I wasn't going to hide the fact that I had had an affair and that I had lied, because how do you solve one problem of leading a double life and kind of being behind a veil by doing it again? So I was just telling this story the other day when my marriage was first ending, a close friend of mine said to me, like, you have to stop telling people that you were having an affair and that that was like a catalyst for the marriage ending. Like, people are going to think really poorly of you. First of all, I mean, we live in an age where kind of people find out things anyway. But second of all, I was like, no, I'm perfectly willing to tell anyone that, because that is what happened. And the whole reason that I am doing this, that like I confessed to my former spouse and that I am trying to figure out what this situation means to me, is that I can't do this anymore. I can't just be this empty vessel that just says things and who nobody knows. I wanted to have more authentic relationship. I don't think when you write a book, it's less cathartic. It's more like you dredge up all these things that are really painful, including like looking at yourself in certain situations can be really painful. So I don't certainly yet feel any kind of like, woo, I'm clean and free now. Like, you know, I don't feel that at all. And actually, I don't know anyone who's written a memoir who had that effect. Like most people are like, no, it was terrible. Now I had to look at myself on the page doing these things and thinking these things. And now I'm more freaked out than ever. But you do it because you know there are a lot of other people out there who are going through similar experiences, not necessarily having an affair and leading a double life, but like similar experiences of caregiving parents, similar experiences of having breast cancer, like all the different things, you know, similar experiences of being in a long marriage, but one in which they're kind of lonely and thrashing. And so all of these different things are going through a divorce, which is incredibly traumatic. So all of these different things, there are so many women out there going through these things. And because the memoir genre focuses so much on the young, I feel like there are not enough stories for these women. And so when I was going through these things and I was voraciously reading literature, trying to kind of find a template, a mirror, something to look into that would make me feel less alone, like I did find a few books, but I didn't find many. And so I wanted to provide one. And I think that that's probably indicative of a zeitgeist. Like, I think if I wanted to provide one, there are hundreds of other women out there who are simultaneously providing them. Like,
Yeah.
I mean, actually, I was thinking about that as you were talking about the idea of having the double life and all of that, and really kind of internally transforming in a way that you can't reveal to your exterior world for quite a while until you finally reach this critical mass of quote unquote not that girl anymore that the book is talking about, that the narrator comes to late in the book. The whole idea of being not that girl anymore, I think, is something that's a lot of modern women are experiencing. And it's not so much not that girl anymore. It's not accepting the societally expected behavior models, maybe. So I was fascinated about that. And I think that that is one thing that's really great about this book, is it is bringing that into the light, the idea of people's ability to transform with the different time periods in their life that they're moving through. And the problem when you're in a double life is you're not able to reveal your transformation while it's happening.
Certainly, right? Certainly. And also your transformation is happening in one sort of narrow space, right? Because it's like a space separate from the rest of your life. The irony of it is that as you're sort of growing and expanding and feeling all these incredibly intense things in the realm of your affair, if you're having that kind of an affair, you're in a sense dimming and becoming less everywhere else because of the line. And so I don't think that sort of a larger growth is quite possible when you are leading a double life. And so if you've had enough epiphanies or you have transformed to a certain degree in one area of your life, it does start to feel like you can't continue to be something totally different in these other realms, even though it may be expected of you. And so that's complex. And you talked also about male rage, male violence. And I think I grew up in a really rough neighborhood, and obviously, of course, as did many people, and spent my whole childhood trying to, quote unquote, get out. I mean, that was my central obsession from the time I was very young until the time I went away to college, but even throughout college, because you don't know what will happen next. And it was like I couldn't get far enough away. Like I kept going overseas. I was working overseas. And the irony was, is that I would do anything to stay far away, even if it meant putting myself into the exact same situation. So at times overseas, I had no money. I was basically homeless, where I was like squatting with groups of men from other countries and so forth, so as to avoid going home out of this sort of fear of ending up trapped in my neighborhood, trapped in the kind of life my mother had led, like not knowing what was next. And so here I was putting myself kind of in risky situations in order to avoid this place where there was so much violence and so many men who kind of glorified criminality, and women, girls who glorified it as well, and who almost felt like flattered to be the object of a man's possession. And so all of those things that I was running from, I kept ending up in those same boxes, even though I was theoretically trying to get away from them.
Yeah. And I have a friend, Bonnie, and she often says, my first husband, you know, because she has several of them. And I think that for a lot of women, their first large relationship kind of models in some respects, or makes them feel comfortable in a place that they felt comfortable culturally or environmentally as a younger person or as a younger girl. But something I just want to make a comment, this isn't even a question, this is just a comment. I really liked the idea of this book giving this place that's more defined for women as they age about claiming the right to write their own endings and change the paradigm. Mm-hmm. Which feels like a really modern sentiment, but it also feels like people get to, like they don't start there. Women get there, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do know what you're saying.
Yeah.
Gina, I wanted to ask you, we saw that you're giving some proceeds from the book to a women's organization. Yes. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. I'm currently donating 100% of my royalties to an organization called Deborah's Place in Chicago that worked for many decades preventing homelessness for unaccompanied women. So basically everything from providing them with housing, with training. It's an organization where the goal is once you've entered Deborah's Place, you will never end up on the street again. And so it's stood the test of time. It's been around for a long time. When I first moved back to Chicago in my 20s, and I have a background in counseling psychology, I used to be a therapist for like 5 minutes. And so I really wanted to volunteer with them. I thought they were really interesting, but then kind of my literary life took over. I was getting a graduate degree in writing and just ended up on a whole different path. So now with COVID and with it being almost 75% of the people who've been forced out of the workplace and who have lost their salaries are women. And obviously the reasons for that are super clear in myriad ways. I mean, obviously, first of all, many women don't have as illustrious employment as men because of sexism because of different expectations. But even those who do, they are still often the primary caregivers. So if you're living in a world where kids have been out of school for 13 months or something like that, a lot of these women can't work. They can't afford childcare. They're home with their kids. And so they get fired and so forth. And I think women are just viewed as more disposable in the job industry. There's still a conception of like, oh, well, you can't fire a man. He's the primary breadwinner. And it's like when in reality, so many women are the head of households now, but there's still all these double standards. And so I think we're in a national crisis of women suffering financial collapse. And so for me, because I wrote the book in order to try to help other women who might need aspects of this story or this cultural lens, I also was very aware, like given my own background, that like, yeah, there's a whole lot of women who don't care about this book at all. They're worried about where they're going to sleep tonight. And I wanted to do something for them as well, because obviously their lives are incredibly urgent. And I think it's really important that we as a culture and that we as women and we as feminists care about that and that we do something.
Yeah, amazing. And we were so, I was very touched to read that. I don't know if you knew this, but I gave all the proceeds of my first edition. Yeah, to the San Diego Family Justice Center, which is for battered women, a place in San Diego. But at any rate, so yeah, that's amazing. And we are looking forward to hearing you read an excerpt from Blow Your House Down. But before we do that, let's have Ran tell us about today's cocktail, which she custom created for this book.
Today's booktail cocktail is an Aperol affair, and the recipe's on the blog if you'd like to make one and drink it and enjoy it while you listen to Gina read, which she's going to do in a couple of minutes. The recipe includes 1.5 ounces of bourbon, an ounce of Aperol, an ounce of simple syrup. You put those things in a shaker with some ice. Give them a little shake. You pour in a glass, add a little Prosecco or soda. It depends on how sweet you like it, and an orange slice for garnish. And that's our drink today.
So shall I read? Is it that time?
Well, is there anything you'd like to tell us about the passage you're sharing today?
So it opens up the book. It's called The Story of A. And this is the one I was referring to where it's like the notes are the book. It was the last edition to the book. And I think that's often true, whether you're writing nonfiction or fiction, that you don't really know what a book is going to be until it's done. And then you have to go back and look at the beginning and be like, oh no, that's not where I was going at all. And so I ended up adding this at a residency in Ragdale after my editor had already bought the book. I added a whole bunch of things that he had never seen. And thankfully, he's fantastic and always willing to kind of follow the detours of his author's mind. So it's called The Story of A, and it begins with a quote that says, "The lie which elates us is dearer than 1,000 sober truths." And my favorite thing about that quote is that it's Anton Chekhov misquoting Pushkin. So it starts, "A is for adulteress, but you knew that. There's virtually no history of literature without the adulteress. Anna Karenina, Emma Bovary, Hester Prynne, Daisy Buchanan, Molly Bloom. The adulteress throws herself in front of a train, runs over her husband's lover with a car, walks into the ocean intent on dying without a care for her children. A is for adulteress, agent of ruin. Woman. A is for accused. Researchers at Cardiff Metropolitan University revealed that when there has been infidelity in a marriage, most wives tend to blame the other woman, whereas most husbands see their cheating wife as the guilty party. Basically, whoever dropped dead in the broom closet, the adulteress did it. A is for author. Allow me to reveal the A on my breast. For the sake of this narrative, my name might as well be A. Once a woman becomes an adulteress, her other identities, mother, daughter, friend, editor, writer, teacher, become largely invisible to others, as irrelevant as the clothing she whorishly, treasonously shed. A is for asshole. There is no slur for men to match the equivalent of mistress or even other woman. Philanderer doesn't have the same punch and is sex nonspecific. Cuckold denotes a man who is being cheated on. A player or even a dog can be single or married. An asshole can be the guy who took your parking space at Trader Joe's, as well as the man who fucked your wife. There are no names specifically for men who break their promises to women. A is for age. For the first time in documented human history, among adults aged 18 to 29 who have ever been married, a general social survey reports that women are marginally more likely than men to be unfaithful. The survey also found that infidelity rates increase in middle age for both women and men, and that contrary to both social and literary stereotypes, women reach their highest levels of infidelity in their 60s. A is for analysis. While wives initiate almost 70% of divorces, the researcher Michael Rosenfeld recently made the surprising discovery that no similar gap between the sexes, or any gap at all, exists between the percentage of breakups initiated by men and women living together without marriage. Rosenfeld also found that although women have long reported lower levels of satisfaction with relationship quality than married men, those in non-marital relationships reported equal levels of quality. These results, Rosenfeld says, quote, support the feminist assertion that some women experience heterosexual marriage as oppressive or uncomfortable. A is for adultery. In the United States, adultery remains illegal across 17 states. In Illinois, where A first kissed her lover, the wrong spouse can even sue the cheater's lover for alienation of affection. In Massachusetts, where A and her lover reinstigated their affair 2.0 after having been broken up for nearly 9 months, adultery is a felony, theoretically punishable by up to life in prison. A is for old, and then I have a line striking that out. A is for hag, strike. A is for crone, strike. A is for ancient. Various recent studies using extensive data from online dating sites have revealed that women's perceived attractiveness by men hits its highest point at the age of 18 and declines steadily thereafter, Elizabeth Birch, and that the peak age of women's attractiveness is somewhere around 22 or 23, Christian Rutter. According to Rutter, co-founder of OkCupid, younger is better and youngest is best of all. For men, by contrast, attractiveness seems to increase steadily with age, peaking somewhere between 46 and 50. Given these facts, one might wonder what irrational force could possibly have prompted A to believe that she still matters enough for all this fuss to begin with, for all this inconveniencing of other upstanding people who had expectations of and plans involving her. Just look at the way she's carrying on, as though she honestly doesn't realize she is statistically unfuckable anyway. A is for the audacity of her. A is for animal testing. In Esther Perel's The State of Affairs, the author indicates that while rates of infidelity are on the incline, public compassion for adulterers is not. According to a 2017 Gallup poll, Americans have become more relaxed about most things sexual, from premarital to teen to gay sex, but adultery remains condemned at higher rates than abortion, animal testing, or euthanasia. A is for audience. Recently, A attended a party celebrating a novel about a married professor who gets a terrifying medical diagnosis and goes out and begins fucking her student. The novel's author began her reading that night by stating that if her middle-aged protagonist had been a man, there would likely be no book because nothing out of the ordinary would have happened. After the reading, all the audience really wanted to talk about was how immoral, inexcusable, and wrong the novel's protagonist was, pressing the author to concur with her judgments and thereby transforming her narrative of disruption into a narrative of reassurance. The author, trained as all women are to be agreeable in crowds, agreed that she did not recommend anyone trying her protagonist's behavior at home, but suggested that that might not be the point. One audience member asserted that the very outrageousness of the protagonist's behavior qualified the novel as satire, even though everyone present, including the men, seemed to agree with the author that had the protagonist been male, there would have been no book at all. A is for Alice. A's mother, Alice, was once told by A's father that she should take a lover because A's father was no longer interested in sex, at least with his wife, and could not satisfy her. Although she had two opportunities that A knows of, altruistic Alice nonetheless remained faithful to her asexual husband, even past his death. A is for anti-heroine. This is not that kind of book. A is for antecedent. In 1997, the year A first encountered her future lover by accepting one of his stories over the transom for the magazine she was newly editing, adultery laws were used to charge a Harvey, Illinois woman with the same crime A would 15 years later commit. A is for aphorism. Esther Perel, quote, infidelity has a tenacity that marriage can only envy. A is for animosity. In the state of Connecticut, where A's lover was born and raised, six people were charged under adultery laws between 1985 and 1990, the year A met her husband. Although a New Haven attorney referred to the law as a dinosaur, Connecticut authorities claimed that they had no choice but to enforce it. A misdemeanor carrying a $1,000 fine, the law also carried the possibility of imprisonment for up to a year. single people cannot be charged, which may be the only aspect of such outdated morality laws that actually break from misogynistic tradition by making it possible to prosecute a cheating husband, but not his so-called mistress, unless she too is married. One can presume that although there are only 6 arrests on record during this time, more than 6 human beings did commit adultery in the state of Connecticut between 1985 and 1990. So in other words, the real requirement for being arrested for adultery is the presence of a spouse who is angry enough at your deception that they would like to see you in prison for it. A is for artifice. It seems the real reason the Harvey, Illinois Police Department charged that woman and the auto mechanic she was sleeping with adultery in goddamn 1997 may have been that they were afraid that her husband, who had come home to find them in bed, would become violent and kill them. Hence, they carted all 3 off to the police department and pressed charges against the wife and the mechanic to hold them there. Cook County prosecutors later decided not to pursue the case. A is for aphrodisiac. Quote, I tried to keep myself away from him by using con words like fidelity and adultery, by telling myself that he would interfere with my work, that if I had him, I'd be too happy to write. I tried to tell myself I was hurting him, hurting others, making a spectacle of myself. I was, but nothing helped. I was possessed. The minute he walked into a room and smiled at me, I was a goner. End quote. Erica Jong, Fear of Flying. A is for atonement. A's lover, when she mentioned wanting to write an amends letter to his wife, quote, she doesn't want to hear from you, and that's never going to change. A's husband on the matter, quote, letters are for cowards. When A thinks of the word atonement, she usually thinks, almost accidentally, alonement. A is for arithmetic. No matter how ashamed of herself the narrator may be, the mathematics of accountability nonetheless dictate clearly that A plus A plus A plus A can never equal I. A is for anger. You may have noticed that anger is making a comeback for women. Or rather, feminism is making a comeback. If anything, second wave feminism fell over its Birkenstocks or slutwalk platform heels, fractioning and infighting itself into oblivion over the notion that feminists were angry, were unsexy, were anti-men. For generations X, Y, and Z, the phrase, I'm not a feminist, but, could often be heard as a disclaimer in college classrooms or drunken parties before any tentative criticism of men could be voiced, as though toxic masculinity, rape culture, and misogyny were all entirely less embarrassing than to align oneself with those feminists, hairy, angry, frigid killjoys. Ironically, only since the 2016 election has a furious brand of feminism achieved mainstream vogue for the first time, with angry women taking to the streets, albeit often in bright pink hats, and exploding the Twitter sphere with their collectively righteous burning of any fucks left to give in lieu of bras. It might be fair to say that this is the moment I've been waiting for since the 6th grade. Except now that all this pent-up rage is finally here, loud and proud, I am not exactly entitled to it. For starters, I am too old, part of the problem, part of the internalized misogyny that led an actual majority of women my age, with my skin color, to vote for a pussy grabber over the most qualified presidential candidate in history. There's that, but also I have been beaten to the punch. As women are finally rising up en masse to denounce their widespread mistreatment by men, I am left naked with no pristine red robe of victimhood. Rather, I have cheated, I have lied, I have done damage, I have been selfish and ruled by my desires. In other words, I have often conducted myself like a man, despite being a mother, and hence have perhaps forfeited my claim on female rage, which carries with it the implicit assumption that women are morally stronger, that we would do things better if given the chance. But I have lost the arrogance of youth, though I cheer it from the sidelines. I've lost the belief in my own high ground, and so my anger hovers in the no man's land of displacement. Who the fuck am I to judge anyone? Or so my party line has gone, in the hopes that my kids, my family, and friends will forgive my transgressions, will understand how sorry I am to have hurt anyone, will understand that I know myself to be a perpetrator here, an equal opportunity dick. What happens, though, if I cannot fold my fury neatly in a closet in favor of my scarlet letter? What happens if my affair has become inextricable from awakening to my own anger, a taboo force that scares me more than all the cumulative male rage I have seen and faced? I need to back into that space slowly before I can fully own it, before I can see the facets and understand what to do with it now. I was about to say, that if you have made it to adulthood without witnessing male rage unleashed, then perhaps you will not understand what I am talking about. Perhaps you will not know what it means that I do not need to be good to be furious. Then I realized the folly of that sentence. You have not made it to adulthood without witnessing male rage. The very best you can possibly claim is that you've made it without that rage being directed at you. A is for art, cannot save anyone from anything, wrote Gilbert Sorrentino in perhaps the first sentence from any book that I ever underlined, ever committed to memory, suspecting that it would somehow both belie and also exemplify the many truths of me. Who was that girl, barely 19, who knew so little of both herself and the transient, tumultuous world that unmakes and reforges us? Who am I now, on the other side of so much wreckage, still loving, still typing, still here? If I believe that art can, in fact, save us over and over again, then does it follow that I risk the audacity of believing that you might be the very one who needs my words to save your life? A is for Anton. Quote, and it seemed to them both that they were within an inch of arriving at a decision, and that then a new and beautiful life would begin, end quote. Chekhov concluded his seminal 1899 adultery story, The Lady with the Dog, which Nabokov considered one of the greatest pieces ever written. Quote, and they both realized that the end was still far, far away, and that the hardest, the most complicated part was only just beginning, end quote. And so it was for me, some 115 years later. And there I begin.
Wow, that's so nice. I'm such a slow, silent absorber. I just want to sit for a moment.
I know, me too. I just want to think about it.
That's so lovely. I'm so glad you read that passage today, Gina. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'm going to ask you what advice you would offer new writers.
Oh, wow. So this is one of my longstanding favorite things to talk about. I've been in the literary community as an editor, not just a writer, since about 1996, when I came on to the literary magazine Other Voices, which I had taken over by 1998, and then launched a book press from in 2004. We published our first book in 2005. And I went on from there to become the founder, co-founder of the fiction section at The Nervous Breakdown with Alexander Chi and Shia Scanlan, and of course, Brad Listy, the owner of the site, and Stacey Bierlein. After that, I was the editor, actually simultaneously with that, I was the Sunday editor at the Ruppus. And as you were saying, I've worked with Triquarterly Online, I've worked with the Coachella Review, and I'm now the creative nonfiction editor at LARB and of the Los Angeles Review of Books. And the reason that I'm saying all this is because my absolute biggest advice to any new writer is to get involved in the literary community. I think that a lot of people, they read something like a best-selling trilogy and they're like, wow, I have ideas. I'm going to write a best-selling trilogy. I'm going to be rich. I'm going to be famous. It's all going to be awesome. I just have to write this book. It doesn't necessarily really matter that I don't read voraciously or that I don't know any other writers. Like, I'm just going to write this trilogy. It's going to come out in three books and I'm going to be a millionaire. And I don't mean to jest, but it works that way for very, very few people. Just even for starters, when someone says, like, I'm going to write a trilogy, you're like, no, you're going to write one book. And if you can get it published, and then if it actually does well, you may write a trilogy, you know? So the publishing industry is really complex. And so I think that the biggest advice that I always give to people is find a way to make this community and this world and this profession rewarding to you, even if you don't end up rich and famous, you know, even if you don't end up with all your goals having come true. And for me, the avenue to that has been to champion other writers, to be able to be the person who is calling someone on the phone and saying, like, we're taking your story or we're publishing your book, and to sort of contribute to the literary community by bringing new voices and by giving people a platform for their work. You know, after my divorce, I unloaded all my unpaid editorships kind of like rats from a sinking ship because I, you know, I was looking for more paying work. But I ultimately came back to working at LARB as an editor because my life was not complete without being able to have a forum for being able to champion work that I loved and get it out there to the world. And so, yeah, I think, like, go to readings once COVID is over. I mean, or, you know, go to Zoom readings, but also Read everything. Don't just read books in, you know, say you like fantasy, like don't only read fantasy, read other types of books as well, and familiarize yourself with what is a literary agent? What is an independent press? How are the big four different from indie presses and university presses? And what kind of a career do you want? And you can't know these answers until you know other writers, you do research, you read, you find out who the people who are writing things similar to yours, like where are they? Where did they first publish? But also you build relationships and you make your life better because people like to know other people who have the same passions and the same obsessions that they do. And so writers like to know other writers. And I think that in our instant gratification culture, like too many people will just write a book and be like, oh, well, three agents rejected it, so I'm just going to self-publish it. And sometimes that works out fine for people. And so, I mean, everyone needs to find their own path. But in my view, like what you gain from, say, having a writer's group, from other people reading your work and giving you feedback and you actually revising and taking that seriously and then working with an editor and revising again, you grow as a writer, you also grow as a person, and your relationships are rewarding and you feel like you're giving something back. So yeah, that's it. It's more, I think that's more important in my view than like write every day from 5 to 6 before your children wake up. Like I think we all write in our own patterns and that you have to find the way that works for you to write. But understanding you're part of a multi-generational conversation and that your peers are those who are alive, who you can get to know, and also those who are dead, whose books you should read, and that this thing is a community. It's all a conversation. Like no book exists without the writer having read a bunch of other books that influenced them.
That's great advice. And writing is such a solitary endeavor. I think it's easy for people to just stay in their little bubble without realizing how important having a community is.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, of course, not everybody can afford to get as involved as I was at certain stages of my career. I mean, obviously, a lot of these jobs don't pay a living wage. Some of them don't pay anything. So not everyone can be like, oh, I think I'm going to found a press. Like, that's very time consuming. And if you have a 60-hour a week day job, you're definitely not going to have a lot of time to do that. But if you have time to go out to dinner, you have time to go to a reading. And if you have time to watch a show on TV, you have time to read a book. So just sort of reconceptualizing how we use our time and how we build community, even if there are a lot of limits financially and time-wise to what you have time to do.
Right. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I also feel like when you suddenly wake up one day and you go, oh, I've known that person for 20 years. Wow, I remember this thing they did way long ago. Or who do I want to make a reading with? You suddenly have this community because you got involved in the community.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. I mean, one of my favorite things, one of the saddest things about this particular book release, although I will be in conversation with a lot of amazing writers over like Comcast and Zoom and so forth. But like, I love the book tour. And I know that's maybe an unpopular sentiment, but like, I love it. You get to go and see all your lit friends like everywhere. And COVID has really made it hard to do that. Our readings aren't geographical anymore. It's like anyone can tune in. And so it's a little more anonymous. And yeah, I miss crashing in people's couches and, you know, being able to like, oh, this is Austin. I mean, so that part is awesome.
Hey, well, you know, I'm in San Diego. We're almost out of this. If you have a book and you want to make a gig here, you're welcome to stay at my house. So listen, I have only one last question for you. It's because I always like to talk about what my next project is, even when I start promoting a book, because it feels like I'm still doing something new. So I want to know, what are you working on now? What do you anticipate your next projects are going to be?
So I usually have a few projects in my head at the same time. Like, for example, my third book, A Life in Men, I had it brewing in my head since 1998, and it got published in 2014. So sometimes I gestate a project for a really, really long time. So I have two novels in my head that I want to write, that I'm playing with, that I'm thinking about, that are starting to creep their way into my obsessions. But currently, my immediate project in front of me, so I went back to my PhD program this beginning of this year, the pre-COVID. And I went back because I had an MA and I'd been teaching at the adjunct level for 25 years, graduate level, undergraduate level. But I realized that I was actually not qualified to, technically, I was not qualified to apply for most academic jobs because they all stipulate that they want a terminal degree, which is an MFA or a PhD, and an MA is not considered a terminal degree. So literally right there, like it states it, so you can't apply. And so I was like, okay, I was getting my PhD 20 years ago, and I left to move to Amsterdam and et cetera for my ex-husband's job. And I mean, living in Amsterdam was awesome, but I just sort of derailed that part of my life. And I was happy about that at the time. I had other things I wanted to do, but I decided to go back. And so I just took like my prelim exams and my critical paper and all that right at the onset of COVID last March. So I am working on my creative dissertation, which is a short story collection. Only one story that has not been published. So I want to write several more before the book is complete. So that will happen by next spring, because that's when I am graduating.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it's really nice, actually. I haven't written much short fiction in a really long time. And it's really exciting to get back to it, because for many, many writers, I think it's our first love. It's what we started writing. A lot of times people kind of give up on it because it's really hard to get an agent and a publisher for a collection compared to a novel. And so a lot of people are just like, agents keep telling you like, let me know when you've got a novel. So yeah, it'll be really fun to return to that.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us at Book Tales today. We really, really enjoyed talking to you and hearing you read your work.
Thank you. It was really nice to be here.
Yes. And everybody, please order Gina's book, Blow Your House Down, and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the Book Tales readings and drinks. Also, subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month, for more conversation with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.